This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Iran once again rejects any proposal for the revision and renegotiation of the 2015 nuclear deal. Russia slams new U.S. sanctions against Moscow as another hostile act which will harm the already poor bilateral relations. And the Israeli parliament dissolves over a budget row, triggering a fourth election in less than 2 years. Hello everyone, thanks for tuning in to World News. And now Iran says it's already gone out of its way to save the 2015 nuclear deal and should not be asked to pay a heavier price.
Iran has paid a heavy price and has done much more than its fair share to preserve the JCPOA. Therefore, no one can expect us to do more. In fact, those JCPOA participants who have for years violated their commitments under Resolution 2231 and the JCPOA must bear responsibilities.
Iran's ambassador to the UN made the remarks in an address to the Security Council. Majid Takht-e Avanchi said over the past 4 years, U.S. has imposed over 1,500 sanctions against Iran, while European countries have utterly failed to uphold their commitments under the accord. He said Iran has been denied the dividends of the agreement and suffered severe damage and suffering. They said that Iran's remedial scale back of obligations are in full accordance with its rights and commitments under the deal and are also completely reversible.
As has been clearly stated by our officials, as soon as all JCPOA participants start implementing their commitments unconditionally, effectively and in full, Iran will also resume implementing all its JCPOA commitments.
Dr. Avanchi further said that any proposal for the revision, renegotiation, or extension of the JCPOA is against UN Resolution 2231 and absolutely unacceptable to Iran. He said Iran will not negotiate its legitimate ballistic missile program, and bullying policies of some powers will not intimidate the country into relinquishing its defensive means. He warned any attempt to link the future of the deal to extraneous issues is doomed to fail. Political commentator John Bosnich joined us earlier saying the manner in which Iran is being treated by other parties to the nuclear agreement is highly irregular.
Well, I have to say that the manner in which Iran is being treated by the other parties in this deal is highly irregular. I've worked as a consultant to governments in Asia, in Europe, and in North America, and not one of those governments would accept these terms. Not one. If you sign a deal and one party, not Iran, one party withdraws from the deal unilaterally, and then Iran continues to honor its obligations under the deal, we cannot say that Iran is the problem party in the case. So, first things first, we know that the deal was not broken by Iran. Number two, the second point, Iran has continued to honor the deal in large part with the very, very limited exceptions which it has notified the international community about, and has continued to say that it will re-implement all aspects of the deal the minute that the parties who left the deal are prepared to return to the deal. So that's the second point. And the third point is that the Western concept of renegotiating the deal after they canceled the deal should be thrown off the table immediately, because until they're willing to honor the original deal, there is no basis for trusting that they will honor a new deal.
Russia has slammed new U.S. sanctions against the country, calling them another hostile act by the outgoing administration of President Donald Trump. Kremlin spokesman warned new round of sanctions will harm the already poor ties between Moscow and Washington. Dmitry Peskov also added that such measures make it extremely difficult to get out of what he called the damaging tailspin in bilateral ties. U.S. Department of Commerce on Monday published a list of Chinese and Russian companies with alleged military ties and restricted them from buying a wide range of American goods and technology. The list contains 103 entities, 58 Chinese and 45 Russian. The U.S. Central Intelligence Agency has trained a brutal hit squad known as a Zero One in Afghanistan. That's based on evidence from numerous sources. The clandestine group of operatives is responsible for a series of nighttime raids which have led to civilian casualties.
The United States has spent the last two decades fighting an endless and unwinnable war in Afghanistan, with the conflict costing the US billions each year, as well as a loss of life on both sides, reminding us all of the embarrassing defeat suffered by the US in Vietnam. But with the US slowly outstaying its welcome in West and Central Asia, as demonstrated by the Iraqi parliament voting to oust them, it seems that Washington is intent on leaving a lasting legacy in the region, particularly in Afghanistan. A secret CIA-trained hit squad known as Zero One has been trained in Afghanistan, with evidence suggesting that the group, who operated under the cover of darkness, are responsible for a series of extrajudicial killings and executions across the country, and most worryingly of all, against civilians. Reports from numerous eyewitnesses and survivors suggest that as many as 51 innocent civilians have been killed, with the youngest amongst them being only 8 years old, as the terror group targets schools, medical centers, and other various institutions. With the raids apparently taking place across four districts in Afghanistan, and with most of the victims having no links to the Taliban, the question arises as to whether there's some kind of partnership between the CIA-trained operatives and the Taliban. According to multiple reports, the US has broken multiple rules of war, breached human rights, and has failed to deliver on any of the promises it made when it comes to building a secure Afghanistan. This raises the question as to just how the US can genuinely justify their presence in the country with so many operational failures in place.
The problem, we're talking about the U.S. presence in Afghanistan and what we call in this country collateral damage, is that there is no justification at this point after 18 years. We invaded Afghanistan allegedly to go after the Osama bin Laden, who it turns out was probably hiding in Pakistan. There was no way the Afghanistani government could accede to the demands that President Bush made when he made them in 2001. And, the justification is just not there. Now, after 18 years...
With attacks such as those completed by the Zero One unit, one official from the Afghan intelligence agency has stated that Americans have always been present during the Zero One raids. But the official failed to distinguish between the blurred lines as to whether the unit were special forces, task forces, or quite simply, CIA agents. What's clear is that the US has a very shadowy modus operandi, and this is something that seems to allow them to get away with the murder of civilians in the process.
CIA has been funding various groups and militia around the world for years now. Examples include anti-communist outfits in Greece, Afghan Mujahideen, as well as groups in Cuba, Panama, Venezuela, Syria, and beyond. U.S. intelligence agency has stepped up operations overseas since the 9/11 attacks hit the country back in 2001. CIA has also put extra focus on nations in West and Central Asia, as well as Western Africa. However, does working both with and against militant groups like the Taliban pose any contradiction in policy and threaten U.S. national security?
With pressure mounting on the U.S. to leave Afghanistan and Iraq, could training such groups by the CIA and U.S. forces guarantee a proxy unit for the U.S. military in the area once they've left? We know from the past that the CIA has a long history of interfering in various sovereign states, and in particular, are keen to arm certain groups to the teeth in order to either justify their presence in an area or quite simply allow splinter groups to carry out the dirty work on behalf of Washington and Langley. In fact, when one looks into the money involved in performing such tasks, the figures are quite boggling, with the CIA allocating some $2.5 billion of their budget to covert operations alone, a sum that equates to around 5% of the total intelligence purse. But when some of the groups backed by the CIA are actually fighting back against the US, including killing its military personnel in the area, does this not create a notion of double jeopardy for the US, showing just how desperate they are when it comes to maintaining a foothold in places such as Afghanistan?
It's a question of desperation. The Trump administration met with the Taliban about a year ago or 2 years ago, as far as we can tell, and basically said, if you stop killing Americans, then we can get out of here, basically. We don't care who else you're killing, but don't kill us. And we can work something out, but if you're killing us and killing our troops, then we're never going to be able to withdraw from here, because we're not going to withdraw under fire. That's basically the United States position.
There may be many similar cases around the world that have yet to come to light. This report, however, has finally exposed the CIA as the main funding party behind the execution of civilians. What remains to be seen is whether such groups will remain US proxies in the future and continue to allow the US to carry out a series of illegal operations, all whilst being able to deny being present at the time.
Israel is heading now for its fourth general elections in less than 2 years after parliament was dissolved over a lack of agreement on a 2020 budget. Now, earlier Tuesday, lawmakers rejected a bill to delay the budget deadline and salvage Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's fractured ruling coalition. Netanyahu's main coalition partner and political rival, Benny Gantz, has accused the Prime Minister of dishonesty and placing his personal needs first. Israel is now expected to hold snap general elections as early as March 23rd. Over the past months, Israelis have been protesting soaring unemployment and Netanyahu's handling of COVID-19. Premier is set to appear in court through January and February for his trial on charges of bribery, fraud, and breach of trust. Joining us now from New York is Rabbi Joseph Kahn, spokesman for Nitzarei Karta International. Hello, Rabbi. Tell us politically what's going on in the Knesset.
Zionism has failed their people from the very beginning. We have seen people for the last couple of weeks protesting against the government, and now we see that the entire government has collapsed. For us, it's no surprise, because the very existence of the state of Israel is a rebellion against God, and it says in the Torah, why are you rebelling against God, and it won't be successful. But for those people who believe in the system of Zionism, they are totally disappointed. They have been on a slippery road with Zionism, and they are totally upset on what's going on with this government. But they have yet to realize that it's not an issue of whether it's a right-wing government, a left-wing party that leads the government. It's the system itself that has created instability in the region. And now they're seeing political instability in a country that has promised them to be stable and a viable place in the country.
And Rabbi, I've heard that before, that Zionism is in direct contradiction to Judaism. Could you elaborate on that a little bit?
Yes, because Judaism is a religion only, with no politics to it, and it's a religion that goes back thousands of years. It's only a covenant that we made with God to serve him. Now, Zionism is 100 years old. It's a new concept that transforms Judaism from a religion to nationalism. It has created the state of Israel in the land of Palestine, a stolen land, against the wishes of the indigenous people of Palestine, who actually also oppose the creation and the establishment of the state in Palestine. And many people will be better off when this government dissolves, not only now until the next election, but we wish that this government, the state, dissolves completely and the occupation ends in its entirety.
Thank you, Rabbi. Stay safe until we speak to you again. Thank you for joining us on the program from New York. It's Rabbi Joseph Kahn, spokesperson for the Nitzarei Karta International. Tunisia says it is not interested in establishing diplomatic relations with Israel, following reports it may normalize ties with Tel Aviv. Tunisian foreign ministry said the country's position will not be affected by international developments. Remarks follow reports by U.S. media saying that Tunisia may be the next Arab nation to normalize ties with Tel Aviv. Now, Morocco is the latest Arab state to sign U.S. brokered deals with Israel after the United Arab Emirates, Bahrain, and Sudan. On Tuesday, an Israeli envoy arrived in Rabat to meet the Moroccan king in the first direct flight between Israel and Morocco. Palestinians have strongly slammed normalization deals with Israel as a stab in their back and a betrayal of the Palestinian cause. Pakistan says anti-Israeli sentiments inside the country and similarities between Palestinian and Kashmiri disputes provide sufficient grounds to reject UAE efforts to normalize Islamabad's ties with the Tel Aviv regime. Pakistan's clear stance on this issue has come after its foreign minister's visit to Abu Dhabi. Javed Rana has more from Islamabad.
Pakistan had a fresh round of negotiations with the UAE in an effort to repair lingering strained relations between the two countries. Pakistan has been under pressure from the UAE to normalize ties with the apartheid state of Israel since August this year, when Abu Dhabi recognized Tel Aviv. For the first time, Islamabad publicly admitted about the existence of a lingering UAE demand to Pakistan to grant diplomatic recognition to Israel, something which Islamabad rejected after the country's foreign minister's visit to Abu Dhabi.
I have abundantly made it clear to the UAE that Pakistan under no circumstances can establish diplomatic ties with Israel until a permanent and durable solution is found to the Palestinian issue. I have told them about anti-Israeli public sentiments in Pakistan and reminded them of the similar nature of dispute between Kashmir and Palestine.
Foreign minister's visit to Abu Dhabi has followed suspension of visas to Pakistani citizens after alleged behind-the-scenes threats to Islamabad to replace its 1.5 million expatriates if Pakistan resisted pressure to normalize ties with the Tel Aviv.
Pakistan made its position clear because of the mounting pressure from some of the Islamic countries. The problem for Pakistan is that at the public level, at the people level, it is very difficult to sell this idea of giving recognition to Israel, because for decades, Pakistani people have been steadfastly supporting the cause of the Palestinian people.
Despite close brother relations with the UAE, tens of thousands of people protested against Abu Dhabi after it normalized ties with the Tel Aviv. Israel has been desperate to normalize ties with Pakistan, hoping that if it happens, other Islamic countries would also follow the suit. However, observers say that Israel's effort through UAE and Saudi Arabia to create compelling conditions against Pakistan to normalize ties have fallen flat. Javed Rana, Islamabad.
Britain reports record nearly 37,000 new cases of the coronavirus as the virus continues to wreak havoc throughout the country. Now, Britain also reported some 700 new deaths as it is battling a surge of a new variant of the virus. So far, it's claimed over 67,000 lives and out of over 2 million confirmed cases. Moreover, British Prime Minister Boris Johnson and his scientific advisors say new variant of the coronavirus, which could be up to 70% more transmissible, is spreading rapidly in Britain. Elsewhere in Europe, Germany has so far reported 1.5 million confirmed cases and over 27,000 deaths. And France is set to ease a temporary UK travel ban introduced after the new variant we just told you about emerged in Britain. French Prime Minister's office says EU nationals and residents will be allowed to enter France from the UK provided they show a negative COVID-19 test that's no more than 3 days old. In a statement, the office added that that test has to be of a type capable of detecting the new variant. So far, more than 40 countries across the world have blocked flights or travel links with the UK. And that's it for your latest, everyone. Thank you for joining us here on World News.
Hi Ravi English Radio, a window to peace of mind and spirituality. You can tune in to RIB English Radio 24 hours a day. We are with you. Are you with us? Are you with us? Are you with us? This is our voice from the heart of the Islamic Republic of Iran, RIB English Radio.
ایمان را در خودتون تقویت بکنید، ایمانی که هم در اینجا شما را شرافتمند می کند و هم در پیشگاه حق آبرو دارید و با آبرومندی وارد می شید به تخت اعلی.
In the path of the Imam.
In the name of God, Salam dear listeners, and we are with you with another episode of this series. This time we are going to discuss the method of Imam Khomeini's behavior with the students of seminaries, especially his system of payment of tuition to them. Stay tuned, please. According to a religious tradition, the students who study in seminaries receive tuition from the sources of emulation in order not to face financial problems. This tuition is paid on the basis of the level of education. This tuition is maintained by the money gathered from almsgiving, mainly in the form of khums and zakat and endowments. Thus, the government has no role in this. That's why the Shia clerical structure has been independent of the ruling system throughout history. Since the early years of the advent of Islam, righteous and pious people have endowed large swathes of properties, including real estates, gardens, farms, factories, shops, etc., to the seminaries so that they could use them for administration of those religious centers. These monies are spent for education, teaching, research, propagation, management, and relevant jobs. Of course, the money paid to the students is not sufficient for an ordinary livelihood. Therefore, the seminary students have to lead a very simple life and forget about many daily requirements, let alone luxurious life. Payment of tuition to the seminary students is based on Ayah 41 of Surah Anfal of the Noble Quran, part of which reads, "And know that whatever you gain, one-fifth of it is for God and for the messenger and for the near of kin and the orphans and the needy and the wayfarer." According to the jurisprudential terms, khums means one-fifth of a person's annual income that should be paid to the Imam of the age and the descendants of Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, with special conditions. Of course, during the time of Imam Mahdi's occultation, this money should be paid to sources of emulation. Consists of two parts, the share of Imam Mahdi and the share of Sadat or descendants of the Prophet. Half of khums is spent for public usage such as research, teaching, propagation, and promotion of religious sciences, establishment of seminaries, mosques, and helping the poor, calamity-stricken people, and so on. The other half is spent for the poor, among the descendants of the Prophet, since it is religiously forbidden or haram to pay them charity or sadaqah. Sources of emulation spend part of the tuition to propagate and promote the religion, and another part for training of specialists in religious fields and securing a portion of the students' needs. Of course, this money is not paid to the students and ulama who work in a center affiliated to the government, because they are paid by the government. Imam Khomeini, God's mercy upon him, was a great source of emulation, who was very careful in spending tuition to the students of seminaries. In view of the Imam, being hardworking was a high criterion for payment of tuition. Thus, he used to give exams to volunteers and assign tuition for them as students. Late Ayatollah Muhammad Muhammadi Gilani said on this, after the Imam came to Holy Najaf and started teaching Makaseb at Sheikh Ansari Mosque, he assigned tuition for students. Of course, this was done after giving exam by those who he had appointed. Those who could pass the exam would be accepted to receive the tuition. This examination program would cause the students to study diligently. Paying tuition to those who were qualified was of high importance to Imam Khomeini. Hujjatul Islam Mohsen Saghafi says, if Imam Khomeini realized that a student is interested in religious sciences, he would help him as much as he could, no matter if the student was in Qom or other cities, no matter if he knew him or not. If the Imam understood that the student was not able to make money due to studying, he would assist him in different ways, or through his representatives or emulators who gave him money. Dear listeners, Imam Khomeini would react to those students who were not serious and hardworking in education. One of his reactions was to cut their tuition. Hujjatul Islam Sayyid Abdul Hamid Irawani recounts a memory in this regard. Imam Khomeini would choose different methods to encourage students and ulema to learn jurisprudence and attain high degrees. Sometimes, if someone was spending his time lackadaisically, the Imam didn't like to give him tuition. Dear friends, Imam Khomeini believed that paying enough tuition to assiduous students was a way of strengthening seminaries. Therefore, he increased their tuition notably. Hujjatul Islam Sayyid Jafar Karimi says in this regard, one day, Imam Khomeini called me and said, the Ba'athist government intends to dissolve the Najaf seminary. Now I consider it as my religious duty to do my best not to let this happen. One of the ways to do this is to embark on the situation of the students and increase their tuition. Hujjatul Islam Kharaghani also said, when Imam Khomeini came to Najaf, the tuition of students was very unfavorable, and most of them were in poverty because the maximum tuition that they received was 2.5 dinars. This was while the rent of a small house in Najaf was almost 2 dinars. As the Imam came, the first tuition that he assigned was 3 dinars. The next month, it increased to 6 dinars, and later on it became 30 dinars. Dear friends, Imam Khomeini used to ask about the condition of students, and if he was informed of a poor student, it would surely help him. Hujjatul Islam Muhammad Ibrahim Ansari Anaraki says in this regard, The imam was heedful of his students, especially the young ones, and would inquire about their situation constantly. If they were needy, he would pay special attention to them. Although he was under pressure by the regime and Savak, the Shah regime wouldn't allow people's money to reach the imam, yet he would do his best to help the students. Dear listeners, next time we will continue the discussion.
Spiritual message of Islam.
His door is open no matter who you are. Just take the first step, you'll see it's not so far. If we all open our eyes to see, he is all that we need right now. And we can all come together somewhere, somehow.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. لا حول ولا قوة إلا بالله العلي العظيم الحمد لله رب العالمين وصلى الله على سيدنا ونبينا أبي القاسم المصطفى محمد وعلى آله الطيبين الطاهرين لا سيما بقية الله في الأرضين أجل الله تعالى فرجه الشريف وجعلنا من أعوانه وأنصاره وشيعته. Last night we continued our discussion about the plan of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala for having a society for mankind in which justice and then other values which come under justice would be implemented. And we talked about the historical role of the Prophet Ibrahim alayhi salam. We talked about the Prophet Muhammad. We talked about the central role of Mecca in this plan. And the last verse that we discussed was from Surah Baqarah, verse 143. أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم وكذلك جعلناكم أمة وسطا لتكونوا شهداء على الناس وَيَكُونَ الرَّسُولُ عَلَيْكُمْ شَهِيدًا. As you remember, we said before this sentence and after this sentence, there's a discussion about change of qibla, direction for prayer. And Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, inside this discussion, makes a very general point. So Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says, we have made you a middle, a balanced nation. Allah has planned in the way that Rasul is shaheed for us, he's a witness for us, and by following him, and in particular by making sure that we don't go to any extreme, then we become example for other people. This shows how balance is important. Among many other qualities, Allah says this is one of the central and fundamental qualities. I decided to read a few hadiths about this important point, and I hope inshallah we all rationally follow this discussion. You know, I am very worried that people, you know, may sometimes misunderstand this important point, but I have responsibility to say this anyway. Imam Reza alayhi salam, in his famous hadith to Ibn Shabib, you must have heard part of this hadith because frequently mentioned about Imam Hussein alayhi salam. Ya Ibn Shabib, in kunta baqiyan fabki lil Husayn ibn Ali. Then Imam continued and reached this point. Yabna Shabib, fahzan lihuznina, wafrah lifarahina. وَعَلَيْكَ بِوَلَايَتِنَا. But this is not enough. This is to begin with. The most important thing is wilayah. عَلَيْكَ بِوَلَايَتِنَا. You have to follow us. فَلَوْ أَنَّ رَجُلًا أَحَبَّ حَجَرًا لَحَشَرَهُ اللَّهُ مَعَهُ. If you really love something or someone, you will be resurrected with that thing. If day and night you think about a stone, then you will be resurrected with that stone. I don't know how many people who are going to be resurrected with their mobile phones. Because they can never, you know, get rid of this mobile phone. So it's very difficult. We are so much used to our cars, to our houses, to our, you know, titles. And you cannot say, you know, I am going to be resurrected with all these things and Ahlul Bayt. It's not possible. You have to be careful. By the way, I'm not against anyone who is using mobile now, because I know many people are making notes. It's just a general observation. Please, you know, feel free and use your mobile phones.
Oh, what a wonderful world this would be if we all open our eyes to see. He is all that we need right now, and we can all come together somewhere, somehow. His door is open no matter who you are. Just take the first step, you'll see it's not so far. Down this road that holds all the answers, open your heart to something greater. His holy book speaks pure and true, and always tells us what we must do. His last prophet was sent as a guide, an example by which we abide. There is salvation for those who seek to find the one and only source of peace and understanding of why we are here, who created us, who we must fear. So what a wonderful world this would be if we all open our eyes to see. He is all that we need right now, and we can all come together somewhere, somehow.
Imam Sadiq alayhi salam said to a person called Misma ibn Abdul Malik, أَمَا تَذْكُرُ مَا صُنَعَ بِهِ. Don't you remember what was done with Hussein alayhi salam? قُلْتُ بَلَى. قَالَ أَتَجْزَ. When you remember, do you lament? Do you feel sad? قُلْتُ إِيَ اللَّهِ. I said, yes, by Allah, when I remember the tragedy of Karbala, I feel very sad. وَأَسْتَعْبِرُ بِذَٰلِكَ. My tears also come. حَتَّى يَرَى أَهْلِي أَثَرَ ذَٰلِكَ عَلَيَّ. To the extent that my family see this, the effect of this on me, they see it. You know, this is very important. When it comes to Muharram, especially the first 10 days of Muharram, we should try to have different lifestyle. We should try to change some of the things. We should not, you know, laugh and, you know, joke as much as possible. We should not go to, you know, places, you know, that normally we go when we are happy. So he said, my family would see that I am a different person. فَأَمْتَنِعُ مِنَ الطَّعَامِ. Even I cannot eat. When I remember the tragedy of Karbala, I cannot eat. Sometimes, you know, I think this is not a good habit, but you can have your own view. Sometimes, for example, you know, we watch, for example, you know, on TV or, you know, listen to recording about the tragedy of Karbala, and then we eat. I think this is not good. When something so serious is being played, either you have to watch carefully or you have to switch off. It's not good, you know, to do these things together. So he said, I stop eating. hatta yastabina dhalika fi wajhi. And then people can see this in my face. They see that I am sad. It's not pretending. It's natural. You know, sometimes you have a problem in work. As soon as you reach home, your wife says, you know, what happened? It's clear on your face that you have a problem. A person who is suffering for Imam Hussein, everyone naturally understands that this person has a problem. You don't need to pretend. It's natural. فقال Imam Sadiq alayhi salam said, رحم الله دمعتك. May Allah have mercy on your tears. So beautiful. The tear which is shed for Imam Hussein is so important. The Imam says, رحم الله دمعتك. Then Imam said, أما إنك من الذين يعدون من أهل الجزع لنا. In this case, you are counted as one of the people who lament for us. So you are qualified to be counted as one of those people. So it's not easy. Everyone, you know, can say, I am one of the mourners for Hussein. To be a mourner for Hussein is a very high, you know, quality. Why? You know, very high caliber. وَالَّذِينَ يَفْرَحُونَ لِفَرَحِنَا وَيَحْزَنُونَ لِحُزْنِ. Those who are happy when we are happy, and those who are sad when we are sad.
I'm looking back throughout the years to breathe is hard, and my eyes are choked with tears. Your face and hair are full of light. Now it will soon be time to go. I feel you feeling calm now. Did the angel let you know?
Oh Allah, please send your salutations to Muhammad and all Muhammad. Oh Allah, please forgive us. Please forgive all our sins and mistakes and shortcomings. Please enable us to serve you with full honesty and truthfulness and sincerity. Please include us among the best followers of Muhammad and all Muhammad. Please protect and safeguard our community and our families and our youths from everything that you don't like. Oh Allah, please hasten the reappearance of Imam Zaman Ajjalallahu Ta'ala Farajahu Sharif. Please make our Imam Zaman happy with what we do and what we say. Please answer his du'as for his faraj. Please give shifa to all people who are ill. Please give shifa to people who are ill in their body and in their soul. Oh Allah, please send your rahmah, your forgiveness to all who have passed away, especially brothers and sisters who were attending these majalis in this community and other communities. Our parents, our foreparents, our teachers, our ulama, our maraji, those who have passed away. Please let them be with Muhammad and all of Muhammad right now. And please give long life and blessed life to the parents and to the teachers and maraji who are alive. Oh Allah, please make the last moment of our life the best moment of our life. Wa akhiru da'wana an alhamdulillahi rabbil alameen.
My ummah, he will say, Rasulullah on that day, even though we've strayed from him and his way. My brothers, my sisters in Islam, let's struggle, work, and pray. If we are to bring back the glory of His way. Ya Allah, Ya Rabb al-Alamin, Ya Rahman, Ya Rahim, Ya Rabbi, let the Ummah rise again. Ya Rabb al-Alamin, Ya Rahman, Ya Rahim, Ya Rabbi, let the Ummah rise again, let us see daylight again, once again.
We are with you. What about you?
IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
A new report from prison abolition group Worth Rises has exposed the extent to which corporate America profits from the desperation of the incarcerated. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Alan McLeod Ryder. This article is published under the heading, New Report Details the Shocking Growth of the Prison Exploitation Across the United States of America. Stay tuned, please, for the details of this article. A new report from prison abolition group Worth Rises has exposed the extent to which corporate America profits from the desperation of the incarcerated. The 132-page study entitled The Prison Industry, How It Started, How It Works, How It Harms, blows the lid off the scandalous business practices organizations involved in what has become known as the prison industrial complex, employed to reap billions in annual profits. The prison industry is in our society, and yet we pay so little attention to it, and we know so little about it. This report is really hoping to unveil the prison industry, the government, and corporate actors who are exploiting the fact that they have been in the shadows. Bianca Tylek, Worth Rises founder and executive director, told Mint Press News, in economics, a captive market is a situation where consumers face a severely limited number of suppliers, meaning their only choice is to purchase what is available, usually at much higher price, or make no purchase at all. Most people resent and feel exploited by the higher prices in captive market situations like stadiums, movie theaters, and airports, but prisons take captive markets to a whole new level. Being incarcerated is expensive, with inmates forced to pay for extra food and many things most would consider basic necessities such as toothpaste and phone calls. Often just being sent to a correctional facility incurs a $100 processing fee prisoners must pay, while visitors are often charged background check fees as well. Prisoners' friends and families transfer $1.8 billion into correctional facilities every year. Faced with no other choices, they are forced to accept money transfer fees up to an outrageous 45%. Financial corporations like JPay and JP Morgan Chase partner with correctional facilities in order to ensure the best deal for them and the worst deal for the prisoners. As the report notes, the industry was built on a profit-sharing model between financial services corporations and correctional agencies, the cost of which is layered onto money transfer fees and billed to families. After years of corporate grooming, some agencies now explicitly award contractors to bidder offering the highest kickback percentage. As a result, not only are contracts often awarded to the most expensive service provider, but correctional administrators are also incentivized to limit cheaper or free alternatives from which they do not profit. U.S. prisoners are often forced to use special cards for purchases, many of which charge fees as high as $2.95 per transaction, 95-tenths dollars for declined transactions, and a weekly service fee of $2.50. And on the outside, J.P. Morgan Chase charges a $10 fee to withdraw money from the card at an ATM. Phone calls are often far from free. The correctional telecom market is worth $1.4 billion annually, with charges of awards of $1 per minute. Little wonder, then, that one in three prisoners go into debt trying to stay in contact with their loved ones. While prisoners are given enough food to keep them alive, it is of notoriously low quality, with food poisoning more than six times more likely to occur in jails and prisons than average, the report notes. Nationally, correctional facilities spend just $2.30 per person per day on food, a number lower than the average daily commissary spend per inmate. That is about $2.59. There is no doubt that in many cases, people spend a lot more on commissary than the system spends to feed them. That you can see time and time again. The state tries to spend as little as it possibly can get away with the while upcharging for all of the products that people can purchase in commissary, Talik told me in Press News. Any wages earned while incarcerated are unlikely to greatly outweigh expenditures. Average hourly wages for workers in facility support jobs range between $0 and $0.63, with five states not paying workers anything. Prisons are one of the last great centers of American manufacturing, making everything from military equipment to mattresses to 3 million face masks. 40% of California's firefighters are prisoners, earning only a few dollars per day to risk their lives. The state's response to this summer's wildfires was hampered by the COVID-19 outbreak among its prisons, meaning large parts of its fire response teams were in isolation. Until recently, former prisoners were effectively barred from applying to become firefighters. With almost 2.3 million people locked up across a sprawling network of over 7,000 facilities, the United States has by far the highest incarceration rate in the world, locking its citizens up at over 10 minutes, the rate of European countries like Denmark or Sweden, and over 17 times than that of Japan. Wolf Rice's report notes that $4.6 billion is spent in the U.S. every year on the construction of new facilities. Nearly 600 prisons have been built on or in close proximity to contaminated toxic land, leading to injury, illness, birth defects, and death. And for-profit private prisons are another growing phenomenon in America's incarceration system. Since 2000, the number of people incarcerated in private prisons has increased by 39.3%, compared to an overall rise of 7.8%. Their ubiquity has become so unremarkable that earlier this year, a private prison simulator game went viral, becoming the number one game in Apple's App Store. During the tutorial, at the start of the game, a baton-wielding guard instructs players, telling them that the state pays us good money to manage the lowlifes they send your way. It's perfect business, he says, as he shows you how to send inmates to solitary confinement, something that is near universally described as torture. The game was received extremely positively, with few negative comments focusing on annoying ads and in-app purchases, not the game's concept. The Worst Rises report notes that American solitary cells are so small that 19 of them could fit into an average one-bedroom apartment. For many, a change in government from Republican to Democrat represents an opportunity for a new start. On incarceration, however, Joe Biden and Kamala Harris have been plagued by their close ties to the prison industrial complex. For years, Biden touted his involvement in now infamous 1994 crime bill, which critics say helped supercharge mass incarceration nationwide. Harris, meanwhile, a former prosecutor and district attorney, used to describe herself as California's top cop and pursued harsh sentences for relatively minor drug offenses, including ones that she herself admits she committed in her youth. Nevertheless, public sentiment towards the issue of mass incarceration is beginning to change.
Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. This is IRIB English Radio.